This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Another day, another data breach, a look back at a country devastated by Ebola, and what a law school does when nobody wants to be a lawyer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 15th of August. Glad you could join us. We begin today with a foreign policy address from Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams followed his speech. She's with me now. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Molly.
All right, let's tackle this thing through the Marketplace lens. What did Trump say that, you know, matters to us? How does his foreign policy tie into the economy?
Well, like he does with many of his other policy proposals, Donald Trump in this speech really laid out foreign policy sort of from a business perspective, talking about the ways that U.S. foreign policy relates back to the economy and how we spend our money. And one of the ways it really bothers him that we spend our money is through this policy that we've done in the past of nation building. He thinks it costs too much money. We don't need to be spending all of those resources. And then when we do spend those resources, we do it poorly. He gave the example of U.S. involvement in Iraq and what we did with the oil there.
If we had controlled the oil, like I said we should, we could have prevented the rise of ISIS in Iraq, both by cutting off a major source of funding and through the presence of U.S. forces necessary to safeguard the oil and vital infrastructure products necessary for us to have the oil.
I would imagine some Iraqis might take umbrage with that suggestion. Kimberly, what about Trump's comments about immigrants and refugees to the United States? That's something he's talked a lot about before.
Right, he has. And he continued with his stance that we should at least temporarily stop immigration from parts of the world where there is a current and ongoing problem with terrorism. He did not specify which parts of the world, but said that he would rely on government agencies once he was in office to pick out those areas. And he also said that we needed extreme vetting of people who are coming into the country. So he called for an extreme vetting process, which would involve things like an ideological test to see if what they want matches up with American values, a deeper background check in terms of where people came from and how they got to the United States, and if people were coming from a part of the world where he views there isn't an adequate screening process, then people will not be allowed in from that part of the world, at least on a temporary basis.
So let's talk a little bit more about this extreme vetting process as it relates to allies. Trump made it clear in his speech that he wants more vetting and qualification of the countries that the U.S. works with. Is that right?
Yes. So there were some countries that he was very clear are our allies and some he was very clear that they are our enemies. Israel, big ally, and he wants to continue working with Israel and solidify that relationship. A country like Iran, he actually said we need to go back to the UN and advocate for stronger sanctions against Iran for the country's involvement with groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. But in other cases, it's not really clear and in some ways contradictory just who is an ally and who is an enemy. And so obviously we need more details on a lot of these proposals, and those are forthcoming.
That's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams from our D.C. Bureau. Thanks, Kimberly.
Thanks, Molly.
On Wall Street today, record highs across the board. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. You will forgive me if this next story sounds like something you've heard before. It's a data breach. I know. This time, cyber criminals may have stolen payment information from customers at 20 major hotel chain properties. The security weakness? Kind of the usual these days. Point of sale systems. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Cyber thieves want to get their hands on your credit card data any way they can. And the point of sale, where you're swiping a credit or debit card, is a big vulnerable spot.
One of the weakest links is the point of sale because you never know who the merchant is. The merchant themselves may be bad. The staff that access it may be negligent or malicious.
That cybersecurity expert, Aviva Leighton at Gartner. She says a retailer may appear to have a good system that transports your payment information securely, but some employees or other users have access to the system.
And the bad guys are getting through the user accounts that are able to access the system. So the most common example is the maintenance guys.
Leighton says a cyber thief can hack a maintenance person's credentials and then access anything they want on a system. But as we move to chip cards, Leighton says, those problems go away. Chip cards generate a one-time transaction code. The card number itself doesn't get transmitted. Cyber thieves can't access it. Problem is, we're not fully there yet. Brian Dodge is with the Retail Industry Leaders Association, a trade group. He says some smaller retailers haven't been able to get their chip card readers certified yet by the credit card companies.
So I have no doubt you've gone to a retailer and seen a piece of tape over the chip portion.
Ultimately, once chip technology is more widely adopted, cybersecurity experts say point-of-sale transactions will be a lot more secure. But are online transactions? Not so much. And that's where cyber thieves may then focus their efforts. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We turn now to the West African nation of Sierra Leone. It's one of three countries that was devastated by Ebola when that disease broke out 2 years ago. More than 4,000 people died from the disease in Sierra Leone alone. The World Health Organization says the situation there is finally improving. The BBC's global health correspondent Tulip Mazumdar was there throughout the epidemic. She recently returned to the capital city of Freetown.
It's rainy season here in Freetown. We've returned to what was once the jewel in the crown of the UK's multi-million pound response to the Ebola outbreak. Today, Kerrytown, on the outskirts of the capital, is deserted and decaying.
That was the entrance, wasn't it?
The triage.
I've returned here with 18-year-old Daniel Touré and his sister Cecilia. Yeah. They were Kerrytown's first survivors.
This is bed two. This was my bed. Ambrose's bed is bed four here.
Bed four, yes, yes.
Their brother Ambrose did not survive.
When I saw him struggle, I started shouting, Ambrose is dying, Ambrose is dying. I don't know what to do. Because...
In total, they lost 27 members of their family. More than 150 lives were saved at this facility. The site was handed back to the Ministry of Health at the end of last year.
The government said this was a place they want to establish a standard hospital for the rural areas. But what I see discourages me more. Something that has not been in reality, and it's a total mess to see it like this.
You can see the big solar-panelled lighting system is still here. And yet this place is completely deserted. The only ones making any use of it are a few stray dogs and a couple of goats. The government says it's planning a maternity unit here by the end of the year. We didn't see any work underway. We make our way back to the city centre, to Freetown's main hospital, Connaught. It's received more than $1 million from the British government.
It's coming into the hospital and we have the very familiar buckets of disinfectant to wash our hands in. This was the isolation unit?
Yes, but now, recently, we transformed this place. And this place.
Dr. Samuel Cisse is heading up the newly refurbished accident and emergency department.
So how have things improved?
Greatly. I believe this is more than 80% improvement.
I've come back to meet Daniel Touré in his home. He lives week to week on various friends' floors. Today, he's hard at work, taking an extra physics class. His fees are paid for by Save the Children, the charity which ran the British Kerrytown site. Inspired by the care he received from doctors there, he wants to go to university next year to study medicine.
Life-saving is one of the most honourable jobs to do in life, as a profession.
In a country with only 200 trained doctors, Daniel's ambition and his success is crucial.
That's the BBC's Tulip Mazumdar from Sierra Leone. Coming up,
which is why I love my job so much, because now I can give back what was so freely given to me.
One woman's life 20 years after welfare reform. But first, let's do the numbers. Great day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 59 points, 0.3% to close at 18,636. The NASDAQ added 29 points, 0.5% to finish at 5,262. The S&P 500 rose 6 points, 0.25%, ending at 2190. Let's pretend it's the late 1800s and talk about rail, steel, and water. Genesee & Wyoming Inc. buys another short line railroad, the Providence and Worcester, for $150 million. Genesee & Wyoming up 3.2%, Providence and Worcester up 50%. U.S. Steel fired nearly 6% after an analyst's upgrade. A glut of steel is ending, thanks in part to a drop in China imports. Steel Dynamics, another steel producer, gained 2.3%. And Xylem Inc., a water infrastructure company, up nearly 4% on a deal to buy Sensus, a water technology company. Flowserve Corporation, it makes flow control systems, up 1.6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.56%. And you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. It used to be easy for a law school to make money. You recruit a bunch of wannabe lawyers. They pay you a lot of money. And then 3 years and a lot of late nights in the law library, and the wannabes graduate and become lawyers. It was all working great until the recession hit American law firms. And now a lot of those wannabe lawyers want to be something else. So what is a law school to do? From Wilmington, Delaware, Avi Wolfman-Arendt has the story.
Hospitals can be noisy places, children's hospitals especially. But at St. Christopher's in North Philadelphia, there is one sound that cuts through the din. That's the clack of Cheryl Kettinger's heels as she makes her rounds.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, we hear footsteps.
Yeah. I hear that people always say to me, I hear you coming because of my walking.
Doctors and nurses may prefer flats and clogs, but Kettinger isn't a doctor or a nurse. She's a law school graduate. She's also not a lawyer. Her area is compliance. Basically, she helps interpret medical law and create company guidelines so people don't break those laws.
My whole goal is to, you know, find a way to do things the right way.
Before she landed her current gig, Kettinger got her Master's of Jurisprudence, or MJ, in health law at Widener University's Delaware Law School just outside Wilmington. There she met a whole host of people like her, people who worked with the law but weren't lawyers.
I had OR nurses in my class. You had people in the pharmaceutical industry, you had social workers. So it gave me a broader base of classmates.
That broad base of classmates, those are the people Delaware Law is betting its future on. Dean Rod Smola says close to a third of the school students are in non-JD programs.
And I could easily imagine it going bigger. I could imagine it being in half of what we do.
Most of Delaware Law's new programs are for people in higher ed, healthcare, or finance. It's law school for non-lawyers.
That's a whole new thing for law schools. And it's good for us in terms of expanding our revenue streams and diversifying our portfolio.
And Delaware Law needs to diversify. Enrollment in its traditional JD program has fallen by almost 50% since 2011. Smola doesn't think those folks are ever coming back.
I would be delighted if it just held very steady and stable indefinitely. In contrast, where there's real entrepreneurial growth is on the non-JD programs.
Delaware Law's MJ degrees cost about $30,000 a piece, take 1 or 2 years to complete, and are taught totally online. And more law schools around the country rely on these non-JD programs. Nationwide, non-JD enrollment at law schools spiked 45% between 2007 and 2013, according to Law School Transparency, a watchdog group that monitors legal education. But is that a good thing?
We are in a period of innovation right now, and anytime you're in a period of innovation, you're concerned about the type of quality that's being produced.
Kyle McEntee is executive director of Law School Transparency, and he worries schools like Delaware Law are simply creating new degrees as a cash grab, not because people actually need them.
And so I think there's a deep skepticism about the value of these programs.
Cheryl Kettinger has faced that skepticism head on. She recalls one moment in a recent job interview when someone noticed that MJ on her resume.
He said, "You don't want to know what I have to say about this."
But she still got the job, and she still argues with her now coworker about the value of that MJ degree. And that's not totally surprising. After all, she said, he is an attorney. In Wilmington, Delaware, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt for Marketplace.
Years next Monday. That is the actual anniversary of the massive overhaul of the welfare system that was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. The 1996 law prioritized work over education and training, and that made it a lot harder for people on welfare to go to college. So how did work first work out? Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of what happened to two women after welfare reform.
In 1995, Ilana Gamble was living in San Jose, California, divorced with three kids, when she found out her ex-husband was about to get out of prison. So she loaded her family onto a train and moved 3,000 miles across the country to rural La Plata, Maryland.
I had an aunt that owned an apartment building, so I was kind of like, got a place to live. So it worked out. It worked out really well that we came here.
Gamble has reddish blonde hair and clear green eyes. You can tell she has Irish roots. And now, at 53, she can say it all worked out. But back then, she knew her savings wouldn't last long with three little kids. So while she looked for jobs,
I had to go seek help.
Help came in the form of welfare. She got about $400 a month in cash assistance, plus food stamps and a small housing stipend. Eventually, she picked up some weekend shifts, bartending at her aunt's restaurant, and they got by.
Barely, yeah. It wasn't unheard of for me to have to write my mom a check when it came time for taxes, because I would have been borrowing throughout the year, sometimes my mom and my aunt. You know, that's pretty much how I made ends meet.
Gamble didn't like working in a bar, and she wanted a better life, so she signed up for business classes at Charles County Community College, and she did well.
In fact, it's crazy because I was a terrible student in high school. I mean, I'm talking terrible with a capital T.
But in college, at age 33, she was getting straight A's and was on her way to an associate's degree.
I knew I could get the degree, and I probably would have went on then to get a bachelor's because it was so easy, you know, unfortunately. Didn't work out that way.
Partway through her third semester in early 1997, she got a letter from the welfare office. The law had just changed, and to qualify for cash assistance, she would need to spend more time every week in a sanctioned work activity. Gamble says she was told her school hours would not count.
Well, I couldn't go to school and work and go to their work program. There was just no way out of it, so one had to go, and I had to obviously leave school to continue working to support my three children.
She finished the semester and dropped out. It's hard to say how many students like Ilana Gamble left college. Before welfare reform, close to 700,000 people on welfare applied for federal student aid. And just a few years later, that number had dropped by almost half.
The caveat here is there's lots of other things changing at the same time when welfare reform hits.
Leslie Turner is an economist at the University of Maryland. She says in the late 90s, the economy was booming and a tax credit for low-income workers had grown.
All of these things may also serve to push women both out of college and off cash assistance because jobs are plentiful.
Still, she says there's no question welfare reform made it much harder to go to college while receiving benefits. But there were exceptions. And a few hours' drive from where Ilana Gamble's college education ended, A different story played out in Baltimore.
Where's your student profile or your test scores?
Oh, I bought that with
me. Okay, we need that.
That's Patricia Edwards, giving an orientation to new students taking developmental or remedial classes at Baltimore City Community College. These classes can be pretty discouraging, so she runs a support program to help students stick with it.
First of all, I'm honored to serve you in this capacity, okay? Because I started out at Baltimore City Community College in developmental education, okay? So we know what's possible, right?
Edwards is tall with a shaved head. She's wearing long feather earrings. She's 49 now and works as coordinator for academic services at the college. But in the fall of 1998, she was a single mom raising four sons on welfare. By then, the law had changed, but Baltimore City Community College was starting a two-year pilot program. It allowed about 200 students receiving cash welfare to count their school time as work, exactly what Alana Gamble in La Plata hadn't been able to do. That made it possible for Edwards to enroll full-time and support her boys. They supported her, too.
I used to get them to read my books to me while I was, like, ironing and washing or cooking or whatever I might have been doing. They would read the book. They were kind of good at that.
The pilot program was extended, and Edwards ultimately earned two associate's degrees in public policy and general studies. She then went on to get a bachelor's degree and got off welfare. Now she's working on a master's and making a good living helping struggling students succeed.
Which is why I love my job so much, because now I can give back what was so freely given to me.
In her office on campus, the walls are decorated with cards and letters from students she's helped. In a framed photo, she's surrounded by four young men, smiling in tuxedos, her grown sons at a family wedding.
I like to have inviting things in my office for people to ask about rather than a bunch of degrees, because I feel like degrees are intimidating for people who have did a lot of things to mess it up, and it makes you hesitant to ask for the help.
It would be great to say that things worked out so well for everyone in Patricia's group. The University of Maryland School of Social Work studied the pilot program at BCCC. Research Director Letitia Passarella says compared to a similar group of welfare recipients that didn't go to college, those in the pilot were not significantly more likely to be employed or to stay off welfare 2 years later. But they did earn higher wages.
What would have been much more useful is to do some more longer-term follow-up, because much of the research has indicated that the benefits of an education are actually delayed.
But Passarella also studies what happens to people in Maryland overall after they leave welfare, mostly without education and training. Most of them work, but in low-paying industries without benefits or opportunities to move up. In one analysis, only 9% of welfare leavers saw any growth in earnings 5 years later.
That's the important point, because it contradicts the idea that a client can go out and get a job, any job, and then they will experience earnings growth because they gain skills. It seems that that is pretty rare amongst clients who leave welfare.
And that brings us back to Alana Gamble, who you'll remember dropped out of college after welfare reform. She eventually got a full-time job bartending and got off welfare. She's remarried and still lives in La Plata, and today manages a banquet facility for the Navy.
It's hard to do when there's sun in your eyes.
It's a government job with benefits, but she's making under $40,000 a year, less than she made bartending, and less than she'd make doing the same job with a college degree. She never went back to college, though she's thought about it.
I have many times, but it just never was feasible anymore. Just financially, I couldn't do it.
She's not bitter about what happened.
I mean, I get it. I totally get that they want to get people off welfare. And essentially, it worked for me because it forced me off of it. But it forced me into a situation where I couldn't go very far.
And she wonders how far she could have gone with a college degree. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Hear more about how welfare reform changed access to education in our Uncertain Hour podcast from the Wealth and Poverty team. The entire first season is now available wherever you get your podcasts. And And this final note before we go, Comedy Central pretty abruptly canceled The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore today. The network said the show just, quote, hasn't resonated. Wilmore said he was sorry he wouldn't be able to cover the upcoming election, especially since the show had tried to represent more diverse voices than the rest of the media. The show has been on the air for about a year and a half, and as it happens, Kai just talked to Larry Wilmore a month ago about the show's unexpected style.
Give me the thumbnail sketch of how you see your job, other than just commenting, right? Other than just pointing out the craziness.
We go a little further on our show. We try to take the underdog's point of view. We always try to do, as I say, keep it authentic, keep it 100% real. What is the real story under here? What do we really want to find under here that is the truth of something that we want to talk about, mm-hmm. as opposed to just making a random joke about something, you know?
You can hear that full interview at our website, marketplace.org. Wilmore's last show is this Thursday. And that's it for our show, although not for the last time. One last look at the numbers. Today, the Dow gained 59 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ added 29 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 rose 6 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl's back tomorrow. Have a great evening, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.